Αγνή Παρθένε Δέσποινα, αχράντε Θεοτόκε.
Welcome to the Loins of History, a podcast dedicated to connecting history to current events and correcting political and historical illiteracy. My name is Jay, and I'm joined by my co-host Colin. And today we are beginning a new series in as a part of our season 6 Fall of Empires. This new series is going to be about the fall of Constantinople. Colin's going to be leading us this morning, talking about what things we can learn about the fall of Constantinople and how it applies to today. And just a quick reminder for those of y'all, if you leave us a 5-star review and a comment so that we can see your name, we will give you a shout out at the beginning of our next episode. So if you like what you hear, go ahead and 5-star review and a comment. If you're on YouTube, like and subscribe. That really goes a long way to help us out. And with that, turn it over to you, Colin. What do you have for us?
Thanks, Jay. This is going to be a very exciting mini-series of our larger series, Fall of Empires. I think you can call this one Rome Part 2, just because, in my personal opinion, I think a lot of historians would agree with me that the Byzantine Empire, as we know it, is really just a continuation of the Roman Empire just in the east. And Constantinople being the second Rome, I think that's really, I don't want to call this a key takeaway, but I think just to frame the conversation and what we're going to talk about over the next 3 episodes, like the Byzantine Empire is Rome 2.0. They considered themselves Romans. Now, they often spoke Greek, and especially toward the later part of the empire, Greek became the lingua franca, the main language that they would speak, but they still carried Roman customs, Roman courtesies. They still considered themselves carrying on in the Roman tradition. So Constantinople was this new Rome. And so it was this real focal point, not just in their empire, but in the world as a whole, because it sat on such a strategic location. It sits today as Istanbul on a very strategic location on the Bosphorus Strait. So literally connecting Europe with Asia. And a very, very important trade route. So like between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean Sea. So if you want to trade between those two areas, which absolutely vital and has always been, you have to control the Bosphorus Strait. So with that being said, just to give you kind of an overview of the next 3 episodes where we talk about Constantinople, this episode, I'm going to do my best to get you spun up on the Byzantine Empire. Like I said, I feel like this is Rome 2.0, but most people's knowledge of Rome ends at 476, and they're like, that's when Rome fell. Yes, right. But no. The Byzantine Empire dynasty, Eastern Roman Empire, like I said, continue that on. And I'm just going to try and give you an overview and track the decline, so the rise and fall of it, if you will, on its own, up until 1453. And then episode 2 is going to be the actual fall. We're going to walk through that whole battle from
like the siege of Constantinople.
Yep, we're going to walk through the Ottomans laying siege, the city falling, and then episode 3 is going to be the immediate aftermath, because you know, it's kind of interesting, like the fall of the Western Roman Empire happened in 476, and that's kind of where we point to and say that's when antiquity ended and the Middle Ages began. Right. Where 1453, we're like, well, that's where the Middle Ages end. And that's where we begin the Renaissance. So,
yeah, early modern Europe.
Yeah, I mean, technically, Rome really spanned like 2 epochs just about. So very, very cool stuff, like over 2,000 years of history. So,
yeah, it's definitely interesting to think of Byzantine not as this separate and distinct thing, but as like it's still Roman. Like exactly. They're still Romans. They're Romans of the Middle Ages.
A lot of them spoke Greek. Yeah, a lot of them spoke Greek. A lot of them still spoke Latin. Greek became their first language, but
well, Greek was the lingua franca even during the normal Roman Empire, especially around the Middle Eastern traders.
So a lot of in the East, yes, they spoke Greek, but also
the Mediterranean traders.
There you go. There's a running joke that the Romans stole everything from Greece.
Right.
I think I called it out in one of the earlier episodes about Rome establishing their republic 1 year before the Greeks did, and the Roman gods just so happening to be the exact same gods, just with slightly different names as Greek gods, like Roman emperors being known to go to Greece and study in Greece. So right. Like Roman Greece, very, very close.
Hey, can I ask you a question real quick?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what this is all about.
Just, you know, I feel like this is just kind of like laying the significance a little bit. Do you believe the accomplishments of the Eastern Romans to be more significant in terms of like they just lasted longer, right? They lasted, was it Constantinople became a thing in like 300s AD, right?
330 AD, yeah.
And lasted 1,100 years? I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but like did the Roman, like Rome last that long?
Yeah, if you do the math, so Rome, for all intents and purposes, the Western Roman Empire fell in 476 AD. It was founded in 753 BC. Just doing some like real rough math, that's like almost 1,230 years. Like if we were to take the Eastern Roman Empire from...
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, from like from even its founding at 330 AD with Constantine, like you're close, but even then... And we'll talk about this. I think they were not in a situation where they could succeed like the Western Roman Empire to that level, that level of grandeur. Mm-hmm. But what they did, and from the studies that I've done on Byzantines, it's pretty impressive, actually, considering what they were up against. And we're going to get into that. And that kind of gets me into some of the key takeaways as far as while we go through this overview, I want you to keep this in mind. One of the main reasons that Constantinople fell in 1453 was because the Byzantines were fighting an 800-year conflict with Islam, with the nation of Islam. So they were under different caliphates at different times, and we'll talk through those. But there's an 800-year conflict where they really fought mostly unified Arabic and Middle Eastern world. That was unheard of before then. They had the Persians, but slightly different. I'll get into that in a second. The second reason was because geopolitically, where they were located, they were under constant threat. So it's kind of one of those things like you control this focal point, this really strategic city. It's great and you can become fabulously wealthy, but everybody is coming after you. And unlike their Roman, like the city of Rome, they weren't in a backwater. They didn't have a few hundred years to kind of prep and get themselves ready and become a power when all their enemies started showing up. They were thrust into it, and we'll get into that in a second. And then the final one is the rivalry that developed with the West. It really became detrimental, not so much from, well, the West, we'll get into it, did sack Constantinople once, but when the empire was truly on its knees and about to be wiped out, the West at that point had really no interest in coming to save their Orthodox brethren. They just didn't. They had hundreds of years of strained relations, both religiously, economically, militarily. It strained those relations and they had burnt that bridge. And it was a bridge too far for them to cross. And they weren't going to do it. And they kind of left them out there to dry. Now, when Constantinople did fall, there was a shockwave sent throughout the West writ large. And they kind of realized that they made a huge mistake. But again, we'll get into that in the third episode. So keeping that in mind, let's just start going through 1,100 years of Byzantine history here. Technically a little bit more because I'm going to talk about the founding. So Constantinople was originally founded by a city-state in Greece called Megara, not to be confused with one of Hercules' wives. If you're familiar with mythology or the Disney rendition of Hercules, it is actually a city-state on the Peloponnese. It was founded in 657 BC, and it's actually kind of an interesting little story. Founder went to the oracle at Delphi, and he asked, and so it was kind of founded as a colony of Megara. So he went and asked, where should I found this city? Oracle said, on the opposite side of the blind men. And he took that as, okay, well, there's these Chalcedonians on the other side. They obviously can't see how, on the Anatolian side of the river, they obviously can't see how strategic this is. I'm going to build a city right here. So that's when Byzantium was founded. And it was founded as Byzantium, and the founder's name was Byzas. So that's where the name comes from. So for a few hundred years, it existed as an important trading post with infrastructure built out, but largely non-politically important, just a city on a very wealthy trading city. Then Constantine, so if you remember from the Rome series we did and some of the reading you've done, Constantine moved the capital once he assumed full control of the Roman Empire after Diocletian had split the empire into the Tetrarchy. He reclaimed full control of the empire, declared Christianity as the religion of Rome, and moved his capital to Constantinople. He decided to do this because he also saw the significance of where the city, where Byzantium lay, but he saw it as a city that had just enough built, but not enough that it couldn't be overshadowed by what he was going to create. And he wanted to make it his own Rome. So he kind of viewed Rome, and a lot of Christians viewed Rome as a very secular city, still some scars. I think Eusebius writes about this as like he wanted to make it his own Christianized Rome and this kind of mark of Constantine. So he establishes Constantinople. And if you think about it, it's kind of like going, if you're an American, not so much like DC where we built something out of nothing. It was like St. Louis where it's like, hey, there's already a city on a very strategic spot connecting East and West. Like, let's just go pour all our money into this and build a great city. So that's kind of what it was. So Constantine rules, and a few decades later, Adrianople happens. And again, if you remember back to the military episode on Rome we did, Adrianople was a disaster. Emperor Valens was killed. The Roman legions in the east were basically wiped out, and the ones that weren't had to basically man the gates because the Goths were. So Adrianople is I don't remember the exact number, but basically not far at all from Constantinople. So Theodosius I takes control, and he gathers what few soldiers he has, and then basically goes out and picks up a bunch of peasants and farmers and says, you guys are in the army now, and if you decide to mutiny or desert, I'm going to kill you. And he was like, he was kind of a harsh man, but he looked at the reality of the situation, was like, well, hey, and at this point, the empire split again. And so he's like, okay, I'm not getting any help from Gratian in the west. I'm on my own. There are a few miles outside the city. We can't stop the Goths. Like, if we get into a pitched battle with them, we can't do it. So we got to figure something out. So between kind of running these skirmishes, picking up this ragtag army to defend the empire in the east, he kind of uses some diplomacy to keep the Goths at bay, ends up actually defeating them a few times and pays them off and kind of says, all right, leave us alone. And it works. And Theodosius ends up through a series of other events, becomes the last emperor of a unified Rome. So after Gratian was usurped by a man named Maximus in the west, and then Maximus and Theodosius fight, Theodosius kills him, becomes sole emperor. But then he leaves the empire to his sons to split back into east-west, and the Roman Empire would never be united again. So one of his descendants, Theodosius II, builds the Theodosian Walls. And I bring this up because these walls are what saves the city several times up until 1453. The Theodosian walls were these double walls with a moat in the center. And these walls were up to 15 feet thick in some places and 40 feet high, with turrets that had what we would call interlocking fields of fire, meaning that not only did they support the walls, but they also supported each other. So if you had a siege ram or ladders, or one of the towers was under attack, the other towers were close enough that they could support that tower. So if you think about it, that was built in the 5th century, those lasted about 1,000 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Incredible engineering marvel. And you think about it, like you break through one wall, you just fall right into a moat, and it's just like a kill box. So there's just nothing you can do. And he also built walls along the sea, as it's on a peninsula. And like we mentioned about the Bosphorus, the seawall actually saves him a few times when the Umayyads lay siege to the city twice in the centuries to come. But so there's a seawall, there's double walls, basically impenetrable as a city. So those are some of the first two emperors. And then there's a man that comes along later named Justinian. So Justinian the Great, as he later becomes known. So like at this point of the empire, they're starting, with Theodosius II building these walls, they've reconsolidated. So if you were to look at it on a map, they have Greece, they have parts of Thrace, Anatolia, what we would call the Holy Land now, Egypt, but Rome, the Italian peninsula, Spain, a lot of North Africa is gone. So Justinian ascends to the throne in the 6th century, and Justinian decides that he wants to retake the Western Roman Empire. At this point, it's very, you know, it's under basically nominal control from different Gothic groups. I think the Ostrogoths and then the Visigoths have Spain and Italy, Spain and France, Vandals in North Africa. He wants to retake it. So he sends his famed general Belisarius out and actually retakes a huge portion of the former Western Empire. And this is where the Byzantines reach their largest extent of their empire. So they retake all of Italy, most of North Africa, parts of Spain and southern France, as well as further north into like the Balkans area. So if you were to look at it on a map, you're like, wow, that's kind of close. They just didn't really have a lot of France and Great Britain, you know, the Rhine and the Danube, but they pushed out pretty far. Unfortunately, that comes at a cost. And they were constantly doing battle with the Persian Empire to the east at this point. So this is pre-Islam, the Persian Empire, not the same one that we saw in 300 with Xerxes, but they were a fierce rival of late Rome and then the Byzantines as well. And so they were constantly in conflict, and that had really drained the empire of a lot of its resources, funding an army fighting on east and western fronts, as well as some of their northern fronts. Just became extremely costly. And then there was the Justinian Plague. The Justinian Plague decimated the empire's population. So if you think about it, we talked about the Antonine Plague, which affected both the Han and the Roman Empire. The Justinian Plague actually, they think, had the same bacterium as the bubonic plague that came out later.
What time frame are we talking
this
about?
This was
here?
The 6th century. So what, 700 years prior to the Black Death? But still, same strain of bacterium, wiped out some of the population. They end up having to withdraw. And so at this point, the empire slowly begins to slip a little bit and kind of lose some of the territory under some of Justinian's immediate descendants. So like that's kind of the early stages of the Byzantine Empire, the Byzantine Roman Empire. And I say that because now we're at the greatest extent of the empire. And now here's where the general decline occurs over the next 700-800 years. I say general decline because it's not a, hey, we're just constantly going down. There's several periods. There's the Macedonian dynasty's restoration. There's a few periods where they actually push back and expand again, and they kind of culturally revive. But by and large, you can look at this and say they're never going to get to this size again. And it just kind of feels, reading it, that it's inevitably going to all come crashing down.
The like, slow yeah, it, decline, this, the inertia begins.
Like the civilizational inertia occurs. You win a battle, but then you lose two. Or you win a battle, yeah, and then you draw, and then you draw, and then you draw, and then you get hit with a plague, and then you're fighting on two fronts.
Internal divisions.
Time just grinds you down. And I think that's what, if you were to contrast this to the Roman Empire, this one was much slower. Like the Roman Empire, it felt like there was this lack of virtue. People just stopped caring. They lost. It was mismanaged. This weight of corruption all set upon them. And it's just very self-induced. This feels like it, if you were like to take a heavyweight boxing champ and then just get injured over and over. And then they just kind of keep fighting. They never heal. And then they're old. And then the miles start racking up. And then age starts setting in. You have a few too many drinks before a fight. Like you can throw a punch, but you're just not the same. And that's kind of what happened to them. That's where I'm setting the stage for the rise of Islam. So prior to this, I mentioned the Persians, but like prior to this, like the East at this point was very disjointed, I think is probably the best way. Like the Persians nominally controlled all of these different tribes through like sheer like force. But there was clans, there were tribes, there were different nations that existed within the Persian Empire, and they all fought each other mercilessly. And like Persians put their foot down on them, and that's the only way they kept them under control. When Islam began to spread, they now had something that could unite them together. And I say it like unified, kind of tongue in cheek, because they still kept fighting each other. But at least they had a common enemy now, and they could look westward and say, this is our main foe. I hate you. You hate me. We have a different sect. We're from we're Sunni or you're Shiite, but we can look to the east and we hate that guy more. Let's go fight together. And that's kind of when I say the civilizational inertia, it started to really bear down on the Byzantines. So the conflicts with the Muslim world began at the Battle of Muta, and I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, on the Arabian Peninsula in 629. Then there was a siege of Damascus. There was the Battle of Yarmouk, the siege of Jerusalem, and then a siege of Constantinople, all within a period of like 45 years. And so within this period of 45 years, the Byzantines lost control of parts of the Arabian Peninsula, Palestine, Syria, much of Anatolia and Egypt. So like their empire basically got halved within 45 years. And by the way, the Umayyads were now knocking at the door at the siege of Constantinople. And this first siege of Constantinople occurred in the year 674 AD. Yeah. So within, 50 years. And what's crazy, and so there's within the Muslim world, this point, it initially started with Rashidun Caliphate, which lasted a few years, and then it transitioned to the Umayyads. And Caliphate, Jay, keep me honest here, but I believe it stands for like successor. So it's more of a matter of successor, and that's kind of what its etymology is and what it means, but it's really just a political, or in a political sense, it's basically how we're going to organize our theocracy in the Nation of Islam.
Etymologically, caliph comes from khalifa, which means successor.
So perfect. Yep, there you go. So I just got fact checked right there. Perfect. But it's really wild to think about the speed of history. And, at this point in 45 years, they went from extremely powerful to now there's an enemy from the Arabian Peninsula laying siege to Constantinople. And actually, the first siege of Constantinople was when they used the legendary Greek fire to repel the Umayyads and their navy. So it was actually going pretty poorly, but nice. Then they found this Greek fire and they just—
Flamethrowers.
Yeah, basically flamethrowers. And I don't think we have the recipe or know how to make Greek fire now.
Yeah, that's my understanding too, is that we cannot, to save our lives, replicate it. We still don't know how they did it.
Yeah, I think that I've seen a couple, I don't know if Mythbusters did something where they tried to figure it out and they couldn't. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
It's like that and the Greek trireme. We can't replicate a trireme either, can we?
Surely we can do that.
I'm pretty sure.
Look at that. While you're looking that up, I'm going to continue. Either way, they used Greek fire to repel the invaders. Unfortunately, less than 50 years later, they came back again for the second siege of Constantinople. And again, the Theodosian walls were able to withstand the Umayyads. And at this point, there's about a period of 100 or 200 years where the Umayyads are basically chipping away at what's left of the Byzantine Empire. And by the time the Macedonian dynasty of the Byzantine Empire begins, the Byzantine Empire basically exists of kind of Thrace, Greece, obviously Constantinople, like a thin stretch of Anatolia and some nominal city-states along the coast within Anatolia, and that's about it. So they've been boxed in completely by Bulgarians to the north. They've been boxed in by the Umayyads and Turkish tribes in Anatolia almost all the way to Nicaea. That's how far they've been pushed back. And it's weird to think about kind of historically, you look at some of these maps and you go through like the battles and things like that. So like Anatolia, even though parts of it were technically part of the Byzantine Empire, they were contested heavily. So, for this period from the initial expansion of Islam to the Macedonian dynasty within the Byzantine Empire, like most people kind of withdrew to like these fortified cities or like coastal areas. Even though they were part of the Byzantine Empire, they didn't feel safe. They were constantly under raids. They were constantly under attack. Like they would change hands. Cities would be sacked back and forth. So it was like a very dangerous frontier to live on. Kind of a bad time for the Byzantines. And so at this time, like I mentioned, you have Islam driving them from the east. Internally, though, we start to see rifts between east and west on the Christian side. So even though Constantine established Constantinople, and he was given sainthood. I think he's called Saint Constantine, and he is well known for like some of the councils, like the Council of Nicaea that he called, a few other very important things within Christianity. And he settled that in the East. Like the Eastern Church and the Western Church began to divide dramatically. And so obviously, if you know anything about Western history, especially in Western Europe, like the Pope is head of the church and he has absolute authority, kind of arguably higher authority than kings, because the Pope would often sit and dictate diplomatic terms between conflicts and say, hey, you're not going to fight or you're going to cease fighting, things like that. and he had absolute supremacy in the East. Like, there was an archbishop and a patriarch in Constantinople, but the emperor would select that patriarch. And so that caused a huge rift, and like papal authority became a big problem. And so the East didn't really recognize papal authority because they viewed themselves as the authority. And then there was this thing called iconoclasm, where within the East, they would build these incredible paintings, art, sculptures, icons, where they would worship and venerate, and they hated it. And so you'd have these iconoclasts go around and destroy them. It became a massive point of contention between East and West, because the Western church said, hey, there's nothing wrong with this. Actually, you shouldn't do this. By desecrating a picture of or statue of Mary, you're desecrating Mary. The East said, no, that's an idol. And I don't want to get in too much into the East-West schisms and this building point of contention, but essentially they didn't like papal authority and they didn't like icons. And there's a few other church organizations, like on the liturgy of different services and how they were carried out. They just began to disagree. And for us, we're like, that's so minor, but it was a big deal for them back then. And so these rifts start to form. There was what was called the Photian Schism in the 9th century. And that was kind of the first break between East and West. And then, you know, they tried to make amends. And I think they called it like the Union of Churches or something. I don't have it pulled up on my notes. I'm going straight from memory here. But they tried to kind of make amends, but at this point, it was this, you could see like the schism coming. And in 1054, there was a schism. So East and West just broke apart. And now you had the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Western Roman Catholic Church. And that.
Mm-hmm. And to put it, and from the Byzantine perspective, you know, you mentioned a lot of the grievances that, you know, Roman Catholics had against the Orthodox Church. But from the Byzantine perspective, they were, you know, there were the four main bishops in the early church. There was the Bishop of Rome, the Bishop of Alexandria, the Bishop of Constantinople, and the Bishop of Antioch. And those were like the four major centers. And then all like around that same time, the Bishop of Rome was like, hey, I'm the first among equals.
You know, it's crazy.
Like, wait, what?
Jay, I'm glad you brought that up, because you say that, and that's kind of how the Tetrarchy was. If you remember, like Diocletian was like, hey, I'm the first among equals. I'm Augustus, but I'm the Augustus. You can have the title Augustus, and you too can have Caesar, but what I say ultimately goes. And that didn't last very long. But, and you know, it's also interesting looking at those four churches, like Antioch and Alexandria both fell to the Umayyads. So they were no longer really able to have a say, like, They were Muslim at that point. So
but,
most of the Christians.
But if you're like, if you're a Christian in, you know, random, you know, the Peloponnese, for example, like in Athens, and you're a part of the Byzantine Empire, and then this bishop who's in Rome says, hey, I should be the single like head of the entire church. And you're like, what about my bishop in Constantinople? Like, that's
what
the guy that I answer
emperor?
To.
And that's, you look at it politically too, like, okay, I've got my bishop or patriarch, and I've also got my emperor in the West.
Yeah, you're right.
Like the West was still like in shambles for a couple hundred years after the Western. So they were moving nations with borders changing and still kind of almost tribal. So it was a lot easier for the Pope to say, hey, I'm the only one that has it together and has a sense of organization. I'm going to be in charge and what I say goes. In the East, it's like, we're Rome. Like, we are Rome.
I only bring that up to say, I think it's pretty common from a Western, you know, a Western standpoint. When I mean Western, I mean like not Orthodox, right? Standpoint is we kind of look at it and blame the Great Schism on Orthodox, right? Like on the Eastern Roman side, but you know, looking at it from their perspective, like regardless of the theological things, one of the main drivers of that schism was the fact that the Bishop of Rome was trying to assert himself in a primal position over the entirety of the church. And the Orthodox people were like, wait a minute, there's literally no grounds for that at all, except in this like tradition. It's not in the writings of the apostles, etc. But to kind of the bigger point about the, you know, the fall of Constantinople, is we see that the Byzantine Empire was losing friends, and their lack of friends, even for like religious, like even though Orthodox and, you know, Roman Catholics were in the same Christian camp, they were having major disputes, to your point, Colin, and the Byzantines just couldn't, like, they didn't have any friends.
They didn't. They needed to read How to Win Friends and Influence People, because to my point about them being in a geopolitical pickle, because, like, yes, you're at the best part of the Eastern Mediterranean, but you have these hostile Bulgarians to the north in this Balkan area. You later have the Kiev and Rus not too much further to the north. You have these caliphates to the east. You have, you know, that is bearing down on you. And now the one friend you have, you're kind of making enemies with. Not a wise move. And that does come back to bite them, because, like, as we'll see after, well, the Latins take them over for a little bit and begin a Latin occupation, but, like, it affects them trade-wise, militarily. Like, they actually go and fight each other several times. And when I say, like, the West, it's not like, hey, the full force of the Pope. It's like the Normans will go, the Venetians. Some of these crusaders come down and they actually get into conflict. Not the full force of the West, but even still, they're fighting Western armies and nations when they shouldn't be. They have bigger problems. It would be great for them just to focus everything eastward, but they couldn't. They just didn't have that kind of position. So the Macedonian dynasty, so there was, first off, there was a number of dynasties that occurred within the Byzantine Empire, and there's problems with succession. Like, you'd have a great leader, and then they'd be followed by some not so great ones. And part of it would be like, how do we really set ourselves up for succession? And they just didn't do it very well. Like, there were times where you'd have assassinations, court intrigue, you'd have regents ruling on behalf of someone who is too young or incapable of ruling at the time. And then they would be killed or assassinated. And then there was this power struggle.
Sounds like the Han Dynasty.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. And it's amazing that they were able to continue on for 1,000 years, kind of doing this every couple decades. But there was a period. So this was started under Basil the First. And I think it's pronounced Basil. That's probably an anglicized way to say it. But Basil the First, who established like 200 years.
No, it's, if you're going Ramsey, it's Basil.
Basil. Well, I didn't want to make it that anglicized. But Basil the First. And
I just know how Gordon Ramsay says it.
Basil. Anyway, he set up his dynasty lasted for about 200 years. And so it was kind of this golden age, right? So you had Justinian and the accomplishments under Justinian. Under Justinian, the Hagia Sophia was built. They reconquered all of these areas. You had the Corpus Juris Civilis, which is actually like codification of all these obscure laws and like cleaning it up. And actually most of Western law has like origins around this. So, and you'll see like if you do a deeper dive into like the Byzantines, that happens several times where you have like starting with Theodosius, Justinian, and on, like they will recodify these rules, so to speak. And if you've ever heard the term like, wow, that was really Byzantine, it means like deliberately obscure for like it's unnecessarily obscure. It's because there are like customs and bureaucracy over like decades would become just ridiculous and to the point that it's inefficient. And then you have somebody come in and be like, all right, we got to recodify all this stuff. So it happens numerous times, but the most popular one's Justinian. Anyway, so like he's the height, but this under Basil the First and then his son, Basil the Second, like they kind of, it's like a little renaissance really, where they restabilize, they reconquer a lot of the lands that were taken from them in Anatolia. Like they push all the way out to Armenia. They have like a third of Italy. I think some of the islands like Sicily. I don't think they were able to retake Corsica and Sardinia, but Sicily. So like they've reestablished themselves. Like Basil II just decimated the Bulgarians. Like I think he blinded an army, like just ruthless to them. And he like brought Bulgaria to heel. The Abbasids were the caliphate at the time. Like he pushed the Abbasids and just routed them many, many times throughout Anatolia. And so like you had this kind of golden age where it seemed like, hey, we're going to make it for another 1,000 years, so to speak. So you had the Komnenos dynasty, and I butchered that pronunciation. I know, but I'm terrible with it. But when they took over in the mid 11th century, kind of at the end of this Macedonian dynasty, we've restabilized the empire. The Abbasids are at heel. relations with the West are okay, despite the East-West schism. Like, things aren't terrible at this point. The Battle of Manzikert happens. So the Battle of Manzikert was like the equivalent of Adrianople for the Western Roman Empire, just a disaster. So it happened on the fringes of the empire at this point. So almost out to like Armenia. So that really eastern part of Anatolia. And they're basically trying to draw the Seljuk Turks out for battle. And they end up just getting like wiped out. And part of the problem with this battle was it emboldened the Seljuk Turks. It, because it was so far out on the fringes of the empire and the army was shattered, it left the rest of Anatolia open to attack and raids. And so at this point, like the raids just intensify. And within like two or three decades, like the Seljuk Turks have basically marched like all the way back to Nicaea. And like there's a few like tiny little pockets that the Byzantines had held out, but basically they're like, they're across the river from Constantinople again because of this battle. And so at this point, Alexius Comnenus writes a letter to the West, basically saying, I need help. And I think after Manzikert, he kind of realized this civilizational inertia of, we're not going to make it any further. Like, things have been trending down. Just even when they're good, things aren't great. And if we don't get help, we're going to get wiped out. And so that's what part of what triggered the Crusades. The Crusades, if you're familiar, were sanctioned by the Pope and the Church to go and retake the Holy Land and to reclaim pilgrimage sites, the Holy Land, to save their Christian brothers in the East. Well, like the Eastern Orthodox Church were those brothers in need. And so at this time, like despite okay relations, they're still fractured. Like the West still comes to call for glory and all these other reasons that we can get into in another podcast. But like they answer the call. And it was Pope Urban, Pope Urban II had requested, he called the First Crusade in 1095. Many nations come, the Crusades kick off. And so during this time of the Crusades, there's actually like a 100-year period where like Byzantines, it works out great for. They're like, hey, we're going to retake Anatolia. We're just going to walk behind the crusading armies and just retake all this land. And so they do. They retake. They actually restabilize Anatolia. They take back parts of Thrace in that area. Works out great for them. But I kind of look at it like this. Like the crusaders in Constantinople were like a really annoying family member that just doesn't leave. Like they eat all your food. They take your stuff. They break it. Like they just get annoying. And it's kind of like, you know, in Constantinople, they're so cultured and wealthy. Yeah. And it's kind of like your country cousin coming to town and staying with you. And you're just like, who is this bumpkin? Who are these Saxons and Vikings coming down here with these red beards? And, you know, and I'm Germans. Referring to the Varangian guard. But, you know, who are these Saxons? Who are these Germans, Franks? Who are these people? Who are these savages, these barbarians?
Yeah.
And like it kind of starts to wear on them. And in 1204, the Fourth Crusade was launched with the intent to retake Jerusalem. Disastrous crusade every way you look at it. So from the start, like logistical problems, like all of the points, like you think about how difficult it is to move an army. Imagine moving an army thousands of miles over just like trails on foot and horseback. It's really tough. And you need to have like pre-planned where you're going to resupply. Mm-hmm. None of that worked. The Hungarians weren't very hospitable. Like they were just pissed the whole way. And by the time they got to Constantinople, you have thousands of crusaders who are hungry. They're mad. Mm. They're just angry.
Camped outside the city. Wanting to get in.
They're camped out. And the Byzantines are like, nope, no more. We've had bad experiences. Nope. Can't take any, no more charity. And the Venetians who, they have been trading and had a beneficial relationship with Constantinople via trade, are also rivals. So they, because the Crusaders don't have enough money at this point to pay the Venetians to take them to the Holy Land, the Venetians decide, hey, let's convince the Crusaders to sack Constantinople. So all of the rage that the Crusaders were feeling was just redirected toward Constantinople, and they just sacked the city. It was the first time that the city was successfully breached. They sacked the city and it began the 50-year Latin principality or Latin occupation of Constantinople. Really kind of an interesting time period because the Byzantine Empire technically still existed in a few different like rump states. So like there's the Empire of Nicaea. So like a bunch of the aristocrats, and they just fled across the Bosphorus to Nicaea, and they established a Nicaean kingdom. There was the despot of Epirus, where some others went to Epirus on the western side of Greece and the Adriatic. Eastern side of the Adriatic, western side of Greece. And then there was like Trebizond. I think they had their own principality and a few others just kind of. And then meanwhile, there's just like this sultanate of Rum in the middle of Anatolia, just kind of watching the whole thing go down. Yeah. And it's like, what is going on here? So for 50 years, the Crusaders rule. They sacked Constantinople. And you think like it's not their city, so they obviously didn't take care of it. They didn't really refortify it. A lot of the city had been re-ruralizing at this point. Eventually, they're forced out in 1261. In the Empire of Nicaea, all those aristocrats move right back in. And so all these other principalities eventually are like, okay, well, hey, we're back in part of the Byzantine Empire now. We no longer exist. We recognize
they you. Reformed the they Byzantine reformed Empire.
Very quickly, yep. Here's where things kind of go from really bad to worse, though. Like at this point, we're, 200 years away from Constantinople falling. The Byzantines now have a chip on their shoulder that these crusaders came in and they focus, rather than pouring money into like fortifying their empire, because they have the Seljuk Turks right there. They pour all their money, they take all their money out of the empire and they put it into Constantinople to try and rebuild. It's like, okay, but they don't refortify any of these cities. They leave them kind of defenseless, and other parts of the Anatolia defenseless again. So they pull soldiers out. A lot of people flee and go to Constantinople or just migrate west. They start fighting other Westerners nearby, like the despot of Epirus. They still had battles internally with them. They were still fighting with Venetians and other Christians, Italian city-states at this point, as well as the Seljuk Turks. And so like this period of like 200 years is basically them being raided. It's kind of like death by a thousand cuts. Like there's a couple big battles, but not really any of renown, because the Seljuk Turks just kind of one by one went to the cities. They started raiding territory. And before you know it, they pushed into Nicaea. And then at the end of the 14th century, like they take Nicaea over and they're just like staring across the Bosphorus into Constantinople. And if you look at Constantinople, the empire that they control within the 15th century, it's basically the peninsula right around Constantinople, Thessalonica, and I think the Peloponnese. It's like, that's it. Like that's all that's left. So wow. They're just they're in a real tight spot. So, and unfortunately, like they kind of know they're in a bad spot, and they had several times trying to make them kind of a little bit too late. Like a few decades prior to the event, to 1453, they tried to make amends with the West, but like it was kind of too little too late at that point. So,
yeah, and the West was in its own, there was the Muslims. I forget which, was it the Umayyad Caliphate that was in Spain? So it's interesting about
the Umayyad. So like and we'll have to talk about this another time. Like the Umayyads were overthrown by the Abbasids, but not in Spain. So like the Umayyads remained in Spain and they formed the Caliphate of Cordoba, but like they were, for all intents and purposes, like separated by like the long stretch of North Africa from the rest of the Arab, the Muslim world. So they were kind of off on their own, but
there was like the Battle of Tours in like 700.
Yeah.
Who was that? I remember
Charles Martel.
Harkening back to
Charles Martel.
And there was another guy.
There's Charles Martel. There's Pepin the Short and then Charlemagne.
That's what I'm thinking of.
Pepin the Short. So
Pepin was the one that I was thinking of.
Yeah. And so like in the West, like you think about everything that they're dealing with when it comes to like Islam, and like Spain had been invaded. The Visigoths were defeated. Like they were pushed basically into the mountains in the far north, like the Asturias Mountains, the Asturian Mountains in the very far north of Spain. Like they invaded France at the Battle of Tours, where they pushed them back. But there was Arabic invasions of Sicily and Sardinia, Corsica, southern Italy, parts of that, like all over the Mediterranean. So like on top of and then there's the Crusades. So the West was kind of fatigued and they're like, yeah, we don't really want to go help you out at this point. Like we appreciate the amends, but Spain's in the middle of their Reconquista. Most of the Westerners at this point were kind of tired of the Crusades. So you think like 15th century, the Crusades were really big in the 11th, 12th, and 13th century. By the time the 14th rolls or 15th rolls around, no, they have their own problems. Like France and England were fighting a 100 years war. The Italian city-states who had made a lot of money ferrying Crusaders to the Holy Land had now established their own trade leagues, and they were making a lot of money as merchants within the Mediterranean. They had their own armies, and they had their own rivalries to deal with internal to Italy. The Holy Roman Empire was not what it once was. So,
right. Well, and one thing we didn't talk about was the role of the Mongols in this whole thing.
Oh, man.
Was the Mongols came in like the 1200s and like completely wrecked the Abbasid Caliphate.
It's crazy.
Wrecked the Russians.
Well, it's crazy to think about. The Mongols and the Crusaders almost fought each other. Like, that's how close, because the Mongols and the different hordes, you know, so they, the Abbasid Caliphate, it was like the golden age of Islam, where they had like in Baghdad. Baghdad was this like center of culture and learning and excellence and all this stuff. And then it was what, like 1258, Hulagu Khan came in and just like wiped it out, killed like a million people. Right. And they're like, all right, well, I guess the golden age of Islam's done. And then he marched into Egypt. I don't know if it was him or some of his generals, but you know, they were defeated by the Mamluks in Egypt. But like, they weren't far away from Jerusalem and Antioch and some of these crusader states in the 13th century. And yeah, the Mongols had crushed the Russians, pushed them into like a corner of the Northeast. We talked about it on the second episode, I believe, with the Mongol yoke in Russia. They made it into Poland and Hungary, not in a super substantial way, but they did. They were conducting raids and had nominally demanded tribute from some of those places. So, like, the Europeans are kind of like, we got our own stuff we got to worry about. We're fighting each other and we're fighting these other armies. Like, sorry.
I did a quick, while you were talking, a quick search on the Sultanate of Rum. And when the Abbasid Caliphate fell to the Mongols, the Sultanate of Rum and like some other Muslim lesser, you know, sovereigns became vassal states to the Mongols in all of Anatolia. And then once the Mongols kind of had their own succession crisis and they got really weak, that's where you had the Ottoman caliphate, which was in the area of Nicaea. They started taking over the other like warlords, and that's how the Ottomans came to be. And the Ottomans, of course, would be the undoing of the Byzantines.
The final, 1453. They would be the final undoing, the denouement. The end of the end. So, yeah, this spoiler alert, Jay, you ruined it. You ruined the next episode. But the no, that's, I mean, that's a good point. Like, the Ottomans are actually the fourth and final caliphate. They were a caliphate until 1924.
Really? 1924?
Yeah, when modern Turkey was established under Ataturk.
Oh.
I know. Like, kind of the death,
I thought they,
death of
I thought
the
they
world.
Ended in like 1918.
Nope. It was in 1924.
Interesting. I mean, that makes sense. The Brits and the French didn't completely take over Anatolia. They just took over, you know, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Palestine area, Egypt. They didn't completely take the Ottomans off the map. But
yeah, the Ottomans become, I think, in their caliphate, even though the Ottoman Empire began, like you're saying, in the 14th century, they didn't become like the caliphate until like 1517.
Interesting.
But yeah, they become a dominant force within the Islamic world, and they actually have one of the largest empires because of it. But yeah. I mean, I think we kind of painted a pretty good picture here of the Byzantine Empire. Like, they started out very strong. Unfortunately, the civilizational inertia just swung in the favor of a different empire, and it just started weighing down on them. And it was 800 years of conflict before they finally fell. And, you know, alienating some of your friends and being in a position where everybody wants what you have, so they're going to constantly be coming after it, and you're going to be fighting a war on two fronts. It's just not a winning strategy for you.
Yeah. The one of the things that I kind of want our listeners to take away from like this fall of the Byzantine Empire is like, when Constantinople fell in 1453, even though the rest of Europe had pretty much given up on Constantinople, it still sent like shockwaves through the rest of Europe. They're like, oh shoot, like this bastion since time forever ago that has been a bastion of just like the West and Christianity is now under Muslim hands, that like that day in 1453 is arguably like one of the most significant days in world history. And what that did to Europe can't be underestimated. So,
well, no, I mean, it's true because it is the successor to Rome. Like,
right.
And we talked about this in, you know, when we talked about Russia in the very like second episode where we talk about Moscow seeing themselves as like the heir to Constantinople.
The third Rome.
Well, what was number two? Constantinople was the second Rome.
Yeah.
It is the spiritual successor to Rome. And I have to think, and we'll talk about this a little bit on the next episode, but you kind of saw it happening, but you didn't think it actually would happen. Like the walls are too big. Like God is on our side. Like he's not going to let it fall.
Yeah.
So we don't have to do anything. We'll send a couple of mercenaries over there and that's about it.
Yeah. Last question before we wrap up. What, just to kind of recap, what do you think are some of the main themes that led to the Byzantine just slow decline?
Inertia. That's one. And like we said with the Muslims, like they just, you win, then you lose, but you lose a little bit worse than you won. Then you lose again. Then you win, but then you lose really bad. It just seemed like it took a toll. And every victory seemed to come at a high cost, and every loss was a really bad, really big loss.
Yeah,
I can't help but think of, you know, you can go bankrupt a lot of different ways. Like you can withdraw all your funds or spend too much at one time, or you can just kind of nickel and dime yourself till you don't have anything left. That's kind of what it happened with the Byzantine Empire. They just kind of nickel and dimed in all these battles and just started losing. And the fact that I look at it and I think that, man, they were really kind of by themselves. The West had really, you know, because of the religious component, the West had really abandoned them when things started getting really bad, and then turned on them, you know, a few times in the Crusades, like the Fourth Crusade, and then they kind of abandoned them when they really needed them. So I kind of think abandonment, inertia, like those are two of the biggest themes that I can see right now. You know, it's interesting, like reading through and like I skip, it's 1100 years of history. You can't hit every person. Like I would love to go into that, but you read about some of these emperors and they weren't like bad necessarily. A lot of times they're just making the best they could with a very bad situation. Like, hey, this army seems to be kind of unstoppable over here. Like every time we beat them, they come back again and we just keep fighting them and fighting them and fighting them. There's just more of them.
Right.
There's an enemy. I'm picking my enemies. What do I do? So it's not so much like in Rome, it felt like they gave up on themselves. Here it was just like, we're just dying by every cut. Just one more cut to us. That's just not going to heal. We're just dying. Mm. I don't know. So I didn't pick up on the corruption as much. I think Gibbon tries to paint it like a very corrupt society. Like there was in the bureaucracy of it, like there was nepotism and bribes and like, it was probably pretty exotic in Constantinople, but like it wasn't as bad as Rome. Like Rome was such a cesspit that Constantine was like, I'm moving the capital. And other emperors before him were like, I can't even rule from that place. Like starting back in Hadrian's time, he's like, I'm not really, Rome's the eternal city. It's special. It's important, but like, I don't need to be anywhere near it. So
I can't effectively govern from there.
I need to be out in the empire. And that a lot of emperors started doing that after him. Constantine just moved the capital, and then heck, even the Western Roman Empire did it by moving it to Ravenna. So like
Ravenna, yeah.
It wasn't quite the cesspool that Rome turned into. It's just, you're just getting your ass kicked over and over and over again. I don't know what you're going to do. Like you're only going to last so long. And it seemed like Rome had a lot of the, like when we talk about all of these enemies that the Byzantines had, like the Kievan Rus, the Bulgarians, you know, these other Balkan tribes, the Normans, they're fighting with the Normans in Italy a lot. I mean, the Normans, the other Italian city-states, like these different caliphates, they were fighting nations for a lot of what Rome's history before they became like this true power. Like they were fighting like another city. It's like, yeah, we got the Samnites. Okay, well, go fight the Samnites. By the time they fought Carthage, like they were already several hundred years old and had this very robust and structured society that was able to fight them off. You know what I mean? And then they only had to fight the Carthaginians. It's not like they had to turn around. It's like, oh shoot, now we got to go turn around and go fight the Greeks. Like it was just the Carthaginians. So it's kind of like, right, if you're only fighting a one front war, it's a lot easier to win. Even when Rome became massive, like they were still only, it would be like tribal incursions from Germany. Ah, we can go stop. It's an army of 10,000 barbarians. We can go stop them. Where Rome started having problems where it was like, hey, this whole nation of Goths and German tribes right. are crossing the border. How do we stop an army of 100, 200,000 people coming into us, you know, coming into yeah. the empire? How do we stop that? That was what the Byzantines were dealing with all the time. So yeah, that was a 10,000, 100,000 foot view of the Byzantine Empire. And really what I wanted to do- The view from space was really to show you that this was an extension of Rome. It was a really powerful dynasty in its day. They contributed a lot to Western, just history in general, but especially Western history and Christianity. And, you know, similar to, you know, had some similarities to the Han and to the Roman Empire in their collapse and their kind of descent into that collapse behind the inertia. But really, I just wanted to give you an overview. And so you can get an idea that this was a great empire that over hundreds of years just kind of got whittled away until now it's just one final city, like the last stand. It's funny. I think I said this when we first started the series, like empires don't really fall in like one final battle. And like technically speaking, Constantinople and the Byzantine Empire was hundreds of years of a decline. But like there is, we can look at this siege and say like, okay, well here it for sure fully ended at this climactic battle, which is really just incredible. And we're just in the next episode, we're going to walk through like the beginning of the siege all the way to the very end of when, you know, Constantinople was no more.
Awesome. Well, thank you, Colin, for giving us that big overview of 1100 years of history and, you know, kind of tying it to some themes on why Constantinople fell, why the Byzantine Empire lasted as long as it did before it collapsed. So thanks for doing that. I really enjoyed listening to that overview, and I hope all of you, our listeners, did as well. If you liked what you heard, go ahead and like, subscribe, give us a 5-star review, give us a comment. We would love to give you a shout out in our next episode. Also, if you have just, you know, feedback for us, we'd like to, you know, hear from you as well. You can comment on the video. You can shoot us an email at loinsofhistory@gmail.com. You can find us on social media. We're on Facebook, X, Instagram, and YouTube. So give us a shout out there. Tell us what you want to hear from us next. And with that, we look forward to seeing you next week on the Loins of History.